Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And we have a dynamite program this morning. What can I say? My guest is Ellen Brown. Listeners are familiar with her. She's a civil litigation attorney, an author, frequent writer on financial topics, and her latest book is absolutely brilliant. It's called Web of Debt. Oh, I've mentioned it before, but today we're going to talk about it because it's so relevant to what's going on. What can I say about the book? I'm saying a lot about it, but we'll talk a lot about it on this program and on more to come. But the book explains how a private banking cartel got hold of our money creation power and all of the problems that it's created ever since. It also explains what we could do to take it back, to get our power back that belongs to us, that the Constitution says belongs to us, does not belong to private bankers. Web of Debt, it's a book to buy, it's a book to keep, to read, and it's so encyclopedic with so much vital information that it is an invaluable reference source to go back and review stuff that you really need to know and refresh your memory about. And you'll understand the mess that we're in right now and the solution to get us out of it. Well, certainly one of the solutions is to abolish the Federal Reserve. We know that, but there's more as well. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Stephen, and thanks for the nice introduction.
Oh, well, I am so overwhelmed by your book and, again, the relevance because of what's going on today that we have to talk about it and then do it again. But my goodness, you talk about the real inner workings of the financial system, and you go into great detail in different sections of the book. But you go back to the very beginning, and long before the Fed was ever created, 1913. But you go way back to early presidents that absolutely denounced the idea of a bank controlled by private bankers. Andrew Jackson called it the first bank of the United States a Hydra-headed monster. Gee, I'd love to have him as a guest on the program. That's the kind of guest I want to have on. And Thomas Jefferson got the Congress not to renew the first charter of the bank. Oh, I want to let you talk about it. And you go back to the colonies when we created our own money, the 13 colonies, and we had 25 years of continuous prosperity, no inflation, no taxes. My God, it was utopia. Why did we ever let these bankers take that away from us? Oh, and a minute before we take the first break, Ellen, jump in and talk about your wonderful book.
Thanks. Well, we didn't let them take it away. The King George forbade the colonies from issuing further. They were issuing paper scrip, and that, according to Benjamin Franklin, was responsible for the abundance in the colonies. But King George said we couldn't do it anymore, and we had to pay taxes to England in gold. And, of course, we didn't have gold. That's the reason we started up the paper money system in the first place. So that put the farmers heavily in debt, and they were losing their farms, and so they rebelled. And that was, according to Benjamin Franklin, that was actually one of the precipitating causes of the revolution. I mean, it wasn't just the tax. It was the fact that they didn't have the money to pay the tax because their own form of money had been taken away from them.
Oh, indeed. And I will pin the blame on King George. Let's take a break, Ellen, and we'll come right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. We're on with Ellen Brown talking about her book, Web of Debt. Ellen, among other things in your book, you've got such extraordinary quotes. Later on, we can get to the one that the Lincoln one that just knocks you right off the chair. You've also got a John Adams quote, and he was an ally of Alexander Hamilton. I call him the Tim Geithner of his day. Whether that's exactly accurate, I'm not sure. But Jefferson called him a traitor. So I guess that may not be a bad description. But John Adams said, and you've got the quote, what Michael Hudson says today and wrote in a recent article, that there are two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. One is by the sword. The other is by death. Can I read one thing and then you can pick it up?
Sure.
I went to the Wikipedia site to the First Bank of the United States, and this is the way they describe it. It's terrible. Created February 25th, 1791. Ironically, Ellen, the same year we got the Bill of Rights, 1791, Constitution, 1787. It says that the charter was for 20 years. The bank was created to handle the financial needs and requirements of the central government of the newly formed United States, which had previously been 13 individual colonies with their own banks, currencies, and financial institutions and policies. What it leaves out is how well that system works. They do deep down in their material, they do admit that the Bank of the United States was a private bank. Just a statement.
Yeah, well, Hamilton, oh, sorry.
No, you go ahead, please.
Hamilton actually did what he had to do because the states were heavily in debt. And the Continental Congress had been afraid to say anything about paper money. They couldn't agree on it, and they had to come up with a paper. You know, there were riots right outside the Constitutional Convention. The farmers and the soldiers wanted their money. So they didn't have enough in gold to pay for their debts and to pay the soldiers, et cetera. And they couldn't agree on paper money. So what they did was resort to the ruse that had been used in England, where they put their money in this bank, which was then 80% privately owned and later 100% privately owned. And then they issued paper banknotes that were all supposedly backed by this gold, which meant you could walk in and trade it in for gold. So it looked like gold. But as the British bankers had discovered in the 17th century, people only came for their gold about 10% of the time, so they could issue 10 times as many notes as they actually had gold. And that's the basic fraud or smoke and mirrors illusion that is at the bottom of our money system today. And that's why it's so vulnerable and has to continually grow. It's this huge literally a mirrors game, you know, where you take a mirror and you put a dollar in a mirror and then it reflects and you can see $10 going all the way back. That's
well,
what it is. So
you're talking about fractional reserve banking.
Right. Each one is one deposit becomes the next. So each one is built on the previous debt. And if you take away that first dollar that you've shown into the mirror, then all the rest of them collapse. And now we have something even worse, which is the derivative scheme where you're not even limited to 10 like it used to be. So the honesty of the system is gone. It's all an illusion. But the answer really is simple, assuming you could you had the power to institute it. That's the problem, is figuring out how to get from here to there. But if you could just start fresh, it would be easy. You just set up an honest system where credit actually represents what it purports to be, and the government actually should be the overseer of this credit because it's really a legal agreement. It's not something dug out of the ground at all. It's not something pre-existing. It's really you monetize your own credit. You're saying, I don't have the money to pay now, but I'll pay it later. Trust me with these little receipts we call money to spend them on my labor and materials and to produce something that will produce a profit, and then that profit will go back and pay off the loan. That's basically what all our money comes from, is credit.
And the Constitution, to me, the Constitution is clear enough, Ellen. They may have used terminology slightly different from today, but Article 1, Section 8 says only the Congress has the right to coin money and regulate the value thereof. Well, to me, that just says only the government of this country has the right to create its own money, not some private banking institution by whatever name it takes. But unfortunately, for most of our history, private banks have controlled the money creation power. But we had some pretty remarkable presidents who didn't like that. Thomas Jefferson, he got the Congress to refuse to renew the Bank of the United States Charter. And a few years later, James Madison did renew it for 20 years, but Andrew Jackson refused to do it. And you explained that during his presidency was the only time in the history of the country that we're debt-free. He paid it off, and we were free of debt, and he just wanted nothing to do with this Hydra-headed monster. And Lincoln felt the same way. He got a greenback law passed, and the country controlled its own money. The private bankers, he needed money to finance the war, and the private bankers wanted to charge absolutely outrageous interest, up to 36%. Well, my goodness, I think even George Bush might have turned that down. 36% interest, 24 to 36% interest. So we printed our own money, and then Lincoln met a bad fate. And the law was rescinded, and the bankers got their power back.
Mm-hmm. Right. Hitler actually did the same thing. And you can make a case, anytime anybody has tried to print their own money, they've gotten in trouble for it. But the Civil War was actually, there is evidence that the Civil War was actually triggered because they were trying to trap the North in debt. That was the only way to bring them back as a colonial power, subservient to England. What they had lost politically, they would recapture economically. But it didn't work. But, of course, it has worked in most of the world, most of the time. The whole IMF thing, where the loans are made knowing that the third world countries' leaders probably won't handle the money well or will can be corrupted by bribery and so forth. So they spend the money. The country is heavily in debt then, and then suddenly the interest rates shoot up, like in 1980 when interest rates went up to 20%. That's what locked all the third world countries into debt, was that sudden rise in interest rates. And then if you look at one of those compound interest charts, once you're in that situation, there's just no getting out of it.
Oh, it's a terrible situation. I did not know the story that you told about Adolf Hitler. For everything he did that we hate him for, he did one extraordinary thing right. He took back the power to create money. I can't imagine a country more decimated economically or financially than Germany post-World War I, where the Versailles Treaty virtually just strip-mined the country of all its wealth, and then they went through the terrible hyperinflation in the early 1920s, and it made it very easy for somebody promising the possibility of a better situation like this to come to power. So Hitler did, not with a majority, by the way. He was appointed chancellor. He never won a majority. And then, of course, once he got it, nobody could challenge him. But he took back the money creation power. And he took a prostate Germany even before he rearmed for World War II, as you explained. And in a few years, he had Germany, during the Great Depression, become very prosperous again. Tell more about that story. I think that's just an extraordinary story. It shows that with all of our troubles now, we could turn it around, too. We're not in as bad shape as Germany was then.
Exactly. That's the theme of my book is The Wizard of Oz, which makes it more interesting for one thing, but it was actually written as a monetary allegory. But that's the thing. We think we are trapped in debt, or we think that we have this scarcity situation going on, but we really have the potential to merely click our heels, as Dorothy did. The silver slippers are on our feet. The way out is there. It's just a matter of changing your understanding of what's going on. When you see through the illusion, you can just set it right. So in Germany, I'm just writing about that now, everybody thinks that what caused the hyperinflation of 1923 was the government printing money. But in fact, the government only printed, it did print money, but it was only doing it to 50% of its budget. Well, England is already doing that. England is exceeding that. It's right now it's printing 60% of its budget. Nowadays they call it quantitative easing, and of course they don't print it. They do it by electronic data entries. But if that's what did it, the mark went to a trillionth of its former value. And the pound certainly hasn't gone to a trillionth of its former value. So that wasn't it. What did it was the speculators. And this was revealed by Schacht, who was the head of the Reichsbank, later in the 60s in his memoirs. He revealed that the Reichsbank had just been privatized, and everybody could see that the mark was going down because there was no way that Germany could afford all these debts. And so the speculators were selling it short. Well, the way you sell short is you have to borrow the money and then you sell it into the market, and then the plan is, the hope is that you can buy it back at a lower price and pocket the difference. So the Reichsbank was madly printing marks to satisfy the speculators, and of course they would take an interest cut on all that. They were profit generating doing this. And then when the Reichsbank couldn't keep up with it, all the other banks were allowed to do it too. So they were all in there madly running their printing presses for a speculative venture. So we do have that going on today, but it's not what people think. It's not the government printing money.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ellen Brown, talking about her book, Web of Debt. Ellen, you make so many valuable contributions in this book, and one of them is to debunk the myth of how inflation comes about. It's not a matter of printing money. You can print all the money you want, provided it's used for productive purposes. And you also explained, you've been talking about it now, that you can cause an awful lot of inflation by shorting a country's currency. And Weimar Germany was one example, 1997, when I don't know who made the decision to do it, but the big hedge funds like George Soros attacked Thailand and its baht, apparently the weakest currency in the region, not because these Asian tiger economies weren't prosperous. The problem was they were too prosperous. They were embarrassing us. So we literally took them down, and we attacked one country, and then we went after others, and we caused a terrible East Asian crisis in 97-98. But explain a little bit more that this idea that printing money is not the root of inflation. It's the balancing that they can make it just fine. And it's worked whenever it's been done that way.
Right. Inflation results when demand exceeds supply, and demand is defined as the amount of money. So if you have, say you have 10 widgets and $10, the price will, $10 competing for 10 widgets, the price will be a dollar. If you inflate the money so that you have $100 competing for the same 10 widgets, that will drive the price up to $10 each. Did I say that right? Anyway, but if you use that $100, you put $100 out there specifically for the purpose of building widgets and make 10 widgets out of it, then you have $100 competing for 10 widgets. I think I said that wrong, but anyway, you see my point, that the currency drives the price up only if it rises faster than the goods and services. So what Hitler did was he had this plan of things he wanted built. The Autobahn was one, housing. He beautified the city, but it was done to put people back to work. People were out of, they had lost their homes. There was definitely much to be done. So he set out this whole plan of public works that he wanted done and calculated that it would take 2 million marks to do it. And then he issued the 2 million marks and paid the workers and materials and built the stuff, and it wasn't inflationary, and it did put the people back to work, and it got the economy back on its feet again. It worked brilliantly well. You didn't exactly issue fiat currency outright or legal tender. What he issued were technically bonds because they were interest bearing. So the government actually paid interest to the bearers, but they circulated as a currency. It was different from borrowing the money from some third party that you're in debt to and then you have to pay interest to. In this case, they escaped the international debts that had locked them down. So what you're doing is you're paying the money to build something as opposed to sending it overseas without producing anything. So Zimbabwe, for instance, is in that position that they had to run the printing presses because they had these huge foreign debts, and the only way to pay them off was to buy dollars. That's another thing. They owed their debts in dollars. I mean, yeah, in a currency that they couldn't print themselves. So what they did was they printed their own currency and tried to buy the dollars. Well, the speculators, of course, knew what they were up to, and so the price of the dollars went up and up and up, and that's what deflated the local currency down, 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 so that it was in the same situation as in Weimar Germany. But that doesn't happen. It didn't happen in Argentina. So it did, of course, the first time in the 90s. But in 2000, Argentina declared bankruptcy and said they didn't have the money to pay off their IMF debts. And then they started printing pesos very quietly, and they used the pesos to buy dollars, but they didn't say they were doing it to pay off the debt. And they just accumulated some dollars over in their treasury. And then when they had the dollars, then they paid off the debt. They said, okay, we changed our mind, we got the money, and paid off the debt. So that did not inflate the currency because the speculators didn't have a chance to jump in there and influence the value of the currency.
A problem really to avoid, I think Michael Hudson writes about this, is to avoid the trap of getting indebted to foreign nations so that you have to pay them off. If you can't do it, the only alternative is defaulting. I guess most countries don't do it, Ellen, but Argentina solved its problem in 2000 or 2001 by defaulting. They would only pay a portion of the amount owed. And I guess they got away with it. Maybe some countries wouldn't have gotten away with it, but they got away with it. And I'm not certain that they put it to their creditors, take it or leave it, but that's what it came down to. And apparently the creditors took what they could get, and Argentina became prosperous again and got back on its feet. We wouldn't...
Third world countries were actually forced into debt in 1974. In 1971, the dollar went off the gold standard internationally. Nixon closed the gold window because we ran out of gold, because France cashed in their dollars for gold, and then England threatened to do the same thing, and that would have broken the bank, essentially. So in 1974, Kissinger made a secret deal with the OPEC nations and said...
We got a break again, Ellen.
Okay.
We got a break. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Ellen Brown talking about her book, Web of Death. Ellen, what really hits home the strongest to me is the remarkable things that happened right here in this country, in the U.S., when we controlled our own money-creating powers. And, of course, the colonists back in the pre-constitutional days, the 13 colonies, 25 consecutive years of prosperity, no income tax, no inflation. And then what Lincoln did, and you wrote, this was your quote, he had to deal, he faced assassination threats even before being inaugurated. He had to deal with treason, insurrection, and national bankruptcy right at the beginning of his presidency. And then you write, Let me just read off some of this, some in your words, some in mine. Considering everything aligned against him, it was astonishing what he accomplished. He built the world's largest army. He smashed the British-financed insurrection. I guess Britain financed the South. They wanted to keep control of the colonies. They just couldn't come around to thinking that they weren't theirs anymore. This country was independent, but they didn't quit easily. Lincoln also took the first steps to abolish slavery. 13th Amendment made it official 8 months after he was assassinated. During and after his tenure, the country became the greatest industrial giant in the world. The steel industry was launched, a continental railroad system, the Department of Agriculture, a new era of farm machinery and sheep tools was promoted. The land-grant college system that established free higher education, the Homestead Act, gave settlers ownership rights and encouraged new land development, free land. Government supported all branches of science. Standardization and mass production was promoted worldwide. Labor productivity increased 50 to 75%. Oh, and more, and we did it all because the government printed its own money, paid no interest on it. We had an income tax during the Civil War because it takes a good deal of financing to finance a war, especially one as mean and nasty as the Civil War. Killed far more people than any other war this country ever fought. And if you put it up into, I once wrote about that, Alan, I forget the exact numbers, about 600,000 people died on both sides. And I think if you applied that in current terms, or in World War II terms, population-wise, we lost a few hundred thousand in World War II. It might have been the equivalent of about 12 million lost lives in World War II, if I remember the number right. But Lincoln accomplished all these remarkable things because we printed our own money and we didn't have to pay interest to private bankers and have all of the fallout and problems related to that. I just think that's a remarkable story. We could do it again today.
Mm-hmm. We could easily. And we are doing it in part, but that's the thing. We're partly going the way that Hitler went in printing his own money to fund internal development. But in larger part, we're going the way of Weimar Germany, where the money is going to pay off speculators. For instance, look at that AIG bailout. We're now 80% owner of AIG, so we're on the hook for their debts. And they've just been paying and paying to pay off these credit default swaps, which are outright blatant speculation, blatant gambling. I mean, it's one thing to say that we should stand behind Fannie Mae because there was this implicit guarantee that they were government-backed. But nobody ever said to Goldman Sachs that the U.S. government was going to stand behind the bets of AIG. So here we are paying off gamblers, which obviously does not put products into the gross domestic product. And that hole is not being filled. They keep telling us that things are looking better, et cetera, but there's always more and more debt yet to be paid, and we still don't know what's coming down the pike. We saw the first of the shopping centers go bankrupt. I mean, there's big commercial properties that are still expected to go bankrupt.
Ellen, when you say we're partially doing today what Lincoln did, do you mean taking over institutions like Fannie and Freddie and AIG? Or?
Oh, no, I meant that Obama's stimulus plan does include infrastructure. And this recent $1 trillion that Ben Bernanke said was going to be put out there basically by quantitative easing or printing money or just created on their books, $300 billion of it is going to long-term government bonds. Well, that is basically funding the government's budget. So that could, and I think should, go toward the stimulus package. They should fund the whole stimulus package that way instead of going to the Chinese, who are losing interest in our bonds, and paying them 4%, go to the Federal Reserve, which is our own central bank, and the Federal Reserve now rebates the interest after deducting their costs. So we get that money for about a 0.5%. It's just the best deal in town. I mean, it would be better yet to just nationalize the Federal Reserve and issue the money directly the way Lincoln did it. But in the meantime, we're inching into that solution, and it seems to me that's the only way we can go. There's no way we can pay off the federal debt, which is actually increasing. There's no way we can continue to pay all these foreign investors. What we need to do is to switch the funding over to our own central government or central bank funding, and when the Chinese bonds come due, pay them off and say, here's your money, but we're not selling any more bonds. We're now funding them through our own central bank. That's what the Chinese are doing. You know, the reason the Chinese are doing so well right now is, I mean, they're starting to turn around, is that they are funding a lot of internal development. And where do they get the money? They own their own, those four commercial banks. They own those banks, the industrial banks, the big industrial banks. In 1978, before that, there was only one bank. It was the People's Bank of China, and they split up into those four big industrial banks, but they were still state-owned. Now they have like 20% private ownership, but they're still creating the credit they need for all these various projects, and it's working really well and always has worked well.
You wrote, for thousands of years, China, I guess, did something more or less like this, where the nation controlled its own money, and it did very well with no inflation, and they had whatever, I don't know the history of China going back thousands of years, but they ran their country very well, much better than when private bankers got hold of it. I guess the difference, the confusion in my mind with when you're saying that we're partially doing what Lincoln did today, Ellen, is that, of course, private bankers still control the money-creating power. And in the 1930s, FDR did to a much greater extent than what Obama says he will do today. But also, private bankers control the system, whereas in Nazi Germany, the government controlled the money-creating system. So that was a major difference. So we were on the hook to the bankers. I suspect that FDR absolutely wanted to save capitalism, and apparently he wanted to save the powerful banks as well. And so he did. He did. And he that was, I think that was the great moment in post the 19th century, Ellen, that things were so bad that maybe if FDR really had wanted to, he could have had his greatest New Deal achievement, end the Federal Reserve as it exists today, as it existed. We didn't have a Federal Reserve then, but bankers controlled the system, just a little less powerful than they can today with a Fed, an established Fed. But he could have changed the system and have the government take back its money-creating power. And that, by far, would have been his greatest achievement. Now, whether he would have lived out four terms is another question.
Well, there was a plot to assassinate him, apparently. So who knows what kind of leverage they had over him. But there was a legislation had been passed saying that the government could issue money itself. And the bankers, I guess, went to him privately and said, we're not going to have this. And that's when this plot apparently was brewed, but it wasn't carried out because the man who was solicited to carry it out decided he didn't want to do it. But anyway, I suspect that Roosevelt was under a lot of, probably was under a lot of pressure. And there's that whole thing about him being aware of Pearl Harbor or instigating it or encouraging it or whatever. I mean,
I think we pretty well know that now, that the plot was to get into World War II, Ellen, and we literally goaded Japan to attack us, and when their fleet was on the way to Pearl Harbor, we tracked it all the way across the Pacific. I forget who wrote a book. There's an important book written on this topic. I think the man is long gone now, but the evidence came out, and he wrote about it in this book. I don't even know the title. And we didn't even warn the commander at Pearl Harbor because we wanted to take casualties like an earlier 9/11 or the first Pearl Harbor. 9/11 was the second Pearl Harbor. And, of course, we got the carriers out to sea because we couldn't afford to lose those. We could afford to lose some other ships. So we let a few thousand of our troops, whatever the number was, killed at Pearl Harbor. We let that happen to literally turn a pacifist nation, just the way we did it to get into World War One, to make us enraged. And Congress immediately declared war, and we went to war with Japan. Hitler had a pact. And Hitler and Italy and Mussolini, they had their axis pact, where if one country was drawn into war with a combatant, the other two would join in. So, and I think this was part of the scheme too, that Roosevelt wanted to get into the European war, and he assumed, and he was right, that Hitler would declare war on us if we declared war on Japan, and Hitler did, and bingo, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It never should have happened in the first place.
Right.
Oh, the ugly truths that we never learned back in school, Ellen.
I know.
I mean, it's astonishing.
That's what makes it all so interesting when you shine this different light on everything. Everything. I read that Marcos in the Philippines was issuing his own money, and things were actually going very well. Well, the way they did with the third world generally was they would trap them into debt and then approach the leaders, and when they were so heavily in debt that they couldn't get out of it. Right now, the Philippines is paying 80% of their revenues are going to pay off foreign debt. They're absolutely in desperate straits. The people are starving, but they can't get out of it. When they try to get out of it, what happens is like in Indonesia where the military is sent in. But apparently Marcos was approached, like they all are, and told that we'll make favorable terms on your debts, but the deal is you have to agree to these conditionalities and you have to assign your mineral rights in perpetuity to us, or give us royalties in perpetuity, our companies. And Marcos wouldn't do it. And at that point, suddenly his name was smeared, et cetera, and he went down. But, you know, just like Clinton was, I mean, they have something on everybody, or they have the ability to make anybody look bad. But I heard from somebody who actually lived there then that the economy was good under Marcos, and it got much better, or got much worse later.
I think he went along with an awful lot of what we wanted from him. I don't know the history that well, but I think also that the people absolutely were in a terrible situation. The Philippines is a poor country, and I think he began to lose popularity. So he may have reached the point where he was scared that if he literally gave away everything, that there could be a rebellion against him. So he wanted to survive. So he would give away a lot, but he wouldn't give it all away. But we did take him down and got someone else in, and we've controlled that country ever since. Mrs. Aquino, what was the name? Cory Aquino. Oh, she looks so sweet and nice, but I guess she agreed to whatever Marcos didn't agree to.
Yeah. The island state of Guernsey was 80%. 80% of their revenues were going to pay off to pay off their foreign debts 200 years ago. And it was just a small island off the shores of England that nobody cared much about, I guess. So they got the bright idea of printing money. They decided they were never going to go into debt again. The government didn't need to go into debt. They had the power to print money as a sovereign power. And so they printed money to build different things that they needed, got their roads back in order, and were suddenly thriving. And they did it just by printing money. But nobody came after them because they were just that small island that nobody noticed, I guess, doing this. But that's a great model. We could do that everywhere. The Chinese managed to do it because they were cut off from everybody else. They were boycotted for a number of years, and so they focused on internal development. And they're just so big, nobody can stop them.
And the currency isn't convertible. I read something that they're considering the possibility of making it convertible. In your opinion, would that be a bad mistake?
You
won.
I they're so big, I think maybe they could still, it seems to me they're pretty much in control right now. I don't know. I used to think that was a bad idea.
As long as they control their own banking system, then they would be less vulnerable to outside attacks.
I think we should do what they're doing. But everybody says, well, wouldn't that be socialism? But, A, they got that idea from us. They got it from the American colonists and from Lincoln. And we have the idea that if your banks are publicly owned, there's something socialist about that, but it's no different from having your courts publicly owned. You don't want your courts to be privately owned. Do you want judges to be able to be bought off and because they're a corporation and their goal is to make money, nobody can stop them? You want the judges to be honest and to be acting in the public interest. Well, in the same way, banks are merely credit facilities. Credit should be a public utility, as Richard Cook says, and banks should be a fourth branch of government, as Stephen Zwillinger says.
And you cover that in your book, and we can discuss that more when you're coming back. You're coming back later in the month, and we can talk more about your book and also the possibility we don't know. We don't attend their private meetings, Ellen, but the possibility and comments going around now of a plot to establish a global currency, get rid of the dollar, and let these bankers have a stranglehold on world economies to a greater extent than now. Oh, we need to take another break. We'll come back and we'll finish up this hour, and at the end of it, it's to be continued. We'll be right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. One short segment left, to my great regret. Ellen, let me just mention this great Lincoln quote, and then you finish up, and you're coming back late in the month, and we can talk more about the book and also the possibility of a global currency, heaven forbid. But this incredible Lincoln quote, I used it before, and you've got it in your book. I'll read it fast. Quote, "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption and high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in the hands of a few and the republic is destroyed." He was pretty much talking about what's going on today and what our status may very well be today, Ellen.
Yes, but I have to admit that quote is probably apocryphal. I think I said that in my third edition. I keep doing new editions, and then in the front I said new things keep turning up to be apocryphal. But there are all these avid money reformers that have written things that Lincoln should have said or that various people should have said. And the thing is, they're so true that it all rings true, and then when you track them down, you can't necessarily find them in their published writings. So my defense to all that, there are people who write to me and they point this out, particularly other money reformers. And
I'll give the guy the benefit of the doubt.
Sorry?
We haven't had a president like Lincoln since Lincoln, Ellen. Well, we had FDR.
And if he didn't say it, he should have said it. It's like there's that one brilliant encapsulation of what his monetary program was, but he didn't actually say that. There's no actual record of him saying it, but it's exactly what he probably would have said had he lived long enough to do it. And it did just brilliantly summarize his program and what the effect of it was. Often you can only see this by hindsight. But it seems to me that when you write about these things, it's like Wikipedia. You put it out there. And I got my book out 2 weeks after the first Bear Stearns collapse in July 2007. So I knew that there might be some things I was on thin ice on, but then you, people tell you. So then you take that feedback and that improves it each time. I mean, partly you get it out there just to see what feedback you get, and then it grows and evolves. And that's one reason I keep writing articles, because this is really an evolving field, and you never know from week to week where it's going to go. It's so interesting.
And in this program, Bill Engel has said that he sees a dark decade ahead. We could have some up and down movement, but I think if anybody thinks that we're out of the woods and we're going to solve this problem and everything will be fine, they're living in a dream world. We have a deep sickness, and I think Bill is pretty right on that. And we really have a long dark period ahead to solve our problems, but the key is doing the right things. And it seems to me we're doing the wrong things, Ellen.
Yeah, well, I have hopes that if you are doing the right things, you can't just stand up and say, all right, we're going to change the whole banking system, because A, you'll get shot like Lincoln and Kennedy did, or at the very least, like in Japan, they did that. There's a party that's has for 10 years been trying to issue currency, but then that brings out the big guns in the media, and they always get shut down. So you have to do it very subtly, like call it something different, like quantitative easing.
And we're out of time. We're out of time. They're going to cut us off. Oh, to be continued, Ellen.
To be continued.
Oh, it was a terrific discussion. I wish we had another hour. We do later in the month.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And join us again tomorrow. We'll have another program. And we'll be touching on the economy again, for sure. Join us then.